Hello and welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 15. Today on the show, I have Jonas Dodu, owner-operator of Speedworks Training Center, London, United Kingdom. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Thanks for tuning in today. Today's guest is Jonas Dodu, owner and head coach at Speedworks, an athletic training center in London that specializes in track and field training as well as team sport training such as rugby athletes. Jonas studied under great coaches such as Dan Paff and Stu McMillan, as he has been part of the great UK apprentice coach program. I've heard Jonas on other podcasts as well as seen some of his material online, and his knowledge in regards to building speed is incredible. And I'm excited to have him on the podcast lineup amongst other great coaches and speed power experts. Some things that Jonas and I'll cover on the podcast today include overall philosophy on speed training, such as the differences between training track versus rugby players, as well as yearly planning ideas. We'll also get into some great specific topics on building speed, such as skill stabilization in the competitive season, the use of dribble runs for tempo training, training elastic versus force-oriented athletes, specific strength work for speed enhancement, and much more. This podcast was a great one. I think you'll particularly enjoy the some portions in the second half where Jonas speaks on a lot of ideas and speed that I either don't see or haven't heard many coaches talking about, but they're really important, and he's got a great mind for the success of the athlete, especially a lot of the little parts of the program that really help to add to the total success. So I learned a lot from recording this one. Here we go. All right, welcome to the show today, Jonas. Thanks so much for being on.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to do this.
Excellent. So right off the bat, I want to get into a little bit about talking training speed in track and field athletes versus team sports such as rugby or soccer or football, basically field sports. How do you go about assessing and training athletes from a track versus a field sport background?
Well, my model for, I guess, for human explosive performance is probably more summarized and simplified into three things. When I'm watching a movement, I want to see, does that person know how to project their hips and project their body? In acceleration, I'm looking more at the horizontal plane, and in max velocity and in any upright running, I'm looking at how they take the vertical but still maintain the horizontal or still continue increasing the horizontal. So projection is my first thing. Then I'm looking at reactivity, and I'm seeing, okay, well, how well do they place the foot? How does the leg cycle and the running technique impact on, you know, how efficient their foot placement is? Franz Bosch and Vern Gambetta, and, you know, those guys, they talk about working from above and making sure the foot comes from above. And people talk about front side mechanics, and people talk about backside mechanics, and just when you look at efficient running, jumping, acceleration, be it from a start or from a already moving, having momentum already, you see just effective performance being defined by having really good solid foot contacts, and you just see efficient people being able to do that. So first projection, then reactivity. And then I look at limb exchange, and I look at how are they applying the force they've got. They've got big bums, big hamstring, big quads, big hip extensors. How are they applying that force? Is it received well through the ground and given back to them in elastic energy? And do their limbs exchange efficiently so that they can do it again and again and again? And those are my three areas. And, you know, when you're looking at acceleration and looking at max V for track sprinters versus field event athletes, you know, the attractors are the same. So that all those things apply. It's just their environment or the type of athlete will impact on, you know, what bandwidth they work within. You know, some people will be longer on the ground at the beginning. Some people will be quick at the ground at the end. Some people have the concentric qualities required to do more horizontal tasks. Some people have more of the elastic qualities for the more vertical top speed. If you're on soft ground, it changes that. If you're on harder ground, it changes that. If you're having to defeat an opponent and be more agile, you know, you might have longer contacts, longer stride lengths, lower hips, but that aids you in evading or attacking. At the same time, I see great attacking players who may be low hipped to get through the game line, who then transition into higher hips and a more bouncy cycle that is faster, but also puts them in a position where when another defender comes to them, they can drop and change direction when they need to. So it's almost a tactical advantage they have, being able to apply what is seen as traditional team sport technique and the more efficient model that you'll see in track and field.
Okay, great answer, Jonas. Could you go into a little bit more detail on kind of clarifying those three attractors and how you might go into using them practically in, say, a rugby player for speed development?
Well, with those attractors, or, you know, the those key areas, I would essentially do my training program, which, you know, in a rugby cycle, it depends how the coach wants to run the cycle. But typically, I come in 2 days before a game. They would have rested the day before, would have done most of their loading the weeks before. So I don't need to hit too much activation on the side of on a maximal strength level. There are some sessions where we would lift before, but most of the time, by that time in the week, I'm going to do what I do with my track guys. I'm going to do some drills. I'm going to do some pulleys, some resisted running. Maybe we'll run up a hill or jump up a hill. And through the session, we'll move from it being very linear and track-based to far more performance-based, where we're having decision-making, attacking, defending, maybe running over hurdles or running around cones with also some ball work. So it's small-sided games, but very, very small-sided games with a lot of speed. So it's, that for me, for the team sport guys, that is the next level, is making sure you can basically build options where they are running very fast but also doing their sport. And in training, that doesn't always seem to always happen for all players. If you're a fly half, you may not have as many high speed meters as the rest of the team, really, especially if you're doing small sided games and you're playing your position more and more. So in my drills, I like to make sure everyone's running fast, and the guys wear GPS, and they have their scores. And, you know, some weeks I come in and the coach will say they've run pretty fast over the past couple of weeks and maybe they're a bit tired, so go in the gym. And so if that means I'm more likely to go in the gym and practice more plyometrics and more jumping options and drills and bits and pieces, but no high-speed running. Other weeks I'll come in and he'll say they haven't been, you know, this player hasn't run faster than 95% or 90% of his max for 10 days or 2 weeks. That's a worrying thing for some coaches, because it means that, okay, he hasn't exposed them to that stimulus. So that day, my job is to make him run fast. And often on those days, they'll run PBs or they'll run close to it. And that for me is the job of a speed coach in a team environment. It's being flexible and moving around their current state and their program. In a track and field environment, you can plan the next 36 weeks, and you know, to some degree, if you know your athletes, know how much intensity you can build them up to, how much chronic load you can actually build up, and how that chronic load, I guess, complements and conflicts with other elements of training, be it speed and speed endurance in gym. So I think your job as a sprint coach is a far more of a organizer of the program, of load, of monitoring. It's the job of the lead S&C coach at a team. So you know, that's the two hats you always have to wear. One is far more about the other boss. You have a boss in one area, and in the other area you are the boss.
Awesome. So you talked a little about planning with track and field. And just generally speaking, what are your thoughts in how do you typically do planning and periodization for speed development? A very large question, but just some general thoughts and methods in that
general
area.
Thoughts. General thoughts are speed is king, and teaching the movements required for speed has to happen from day one with any sport, with any person. You know, at the lowest level, teaching speed is just teaching good movement. And you know, good effective control of your body and efficient movement is required for all athletes. So you're going to have an element of that. But you know, it's also about time. If you've got a lot of time, if you have a track athlete, then you can layer on very large amounts of chronic load over time, and that gives, you know, that means your program is different compared to if you're just trying to get someone fast in 12 weeks' time. But it, you know, I have a complex program, or you know, vertically integrated or concurrent, or however you want to call it. I like to do all things at all times, but I realize that I need to have a complex hierarchy, which means depending on how much time I've got, I will make certain units of training more of a priority than others, with acceleration and speed always being a priority. But if I think some extensive training is needed, and a large amount of it, that means I need to complement it with the right type of speed work, and vice versa. So I think general themes on training, you know, I think in an extensive phase of training in your GPP, I think if you've got a block of, you know, 6 to 12 weeks, you can, in an extensive phase, I think, yeah, you can spend more time doing resisted work acceleration wise. You would really manage your meters of high speed running, and maybe limit the distance of running of speed work to 30 meters, knowing that, you know, or even 20s if that's what you feel, of unresisted running, but complement that with, you know, large volumes of resisted running to 40 and 50 meters. I don't mind doing that at all. And resisted bounding during an extensive phase, whereas in the intensive phase, well, and in that extensive phase, you are spending a lot of time, you know, in the mid zone. You're not really doing speed. You're doing 85 to, well, really, you're doing 75 to 90% of longer runs, more energy system development. Stu McMillan had an interesting comment on doing full maximal sprint work with Andre, and basically said he didn't do any during the season. So I think that created a large amount of inquiry online. I think what I took from the comment is maybe using a free lap and running and training and racing and training some of the splits. So I think he even said this. He either said this to me or he said it online. I think he actually said it online, that he never saw the type of splits in training from Andre that would produce sub 10, or no, maybe not 991, 992. He only brought those kind of speeds out in a race environment. So officially in training, he isn't actually, even if he's running PBs in training, if it's 2.6s rather than 2.5s, it's not the same speed, is it?
Yeah.
So that's definitely an interesting thing to think about with speed work, is what type of speed work are you doing? An athlete running to 40 meters in trainers with maximal effort versus athlete running in spikes versus an athlete running through timing gates versus an athlete running in blocks next to another fast athlete is they're all different stimuli. And so not all speed is alike. And same ways with running sub, the old Charlie Francis chart of, you know, anything in the middle is useless. I think that applies only if you train the Charlie way. And if you want as your main training sessions those week to be speed, but if you decrease the density of speed and you're not doing it 2 or 3 times a week, or if you are doing it, you're doing it at a lower value, you're doing it at a lower level, I think you can use mid zone. And I think the mid zone is great for teaching. You know, the guys of one of my development groups started this week, and I realized watching them how much opportunity there is now to teach what I need them to do in the future. And most of them have been with us through last year, so I've seen the seasons they've had, how they've raced, their strengths, their weaknesses, and I'm seeing them run at probably something like 15 second 100-meter pace. And it's opportunity to cue the ankles, to cue bounciness, to cue switching their limbs, you know, to cue posture, and they can fix it and control it, and then they get loads of steps doing it. So, you know, I think the mid zone counts for that. It's an opportunity to run close to speed. It's similar, it's maybe not the same velocities, but the reflexes and contact times might not be too far off. And it's important. So there's some general ideas on training, and I know I've gone off on a tangent, but
no, that was awesome. I was sitting there the whole second half. I'm sitting there like nodding my head, like stuff I've kind of thought about and considered before. But it was awesome to hear you share your thoughts on that, because I do know a lot of people will, you know, and not wrongfully so, but look at the Charlie Francis model and then just toss out that intermediate stuff. And I those points you're making on how and why it can be useful and is useful is really good for, I think, a lot of coaches to be reminded of. I'm glad you brought that up. Another question I wanted to ask you along the lines of speed, and we talked a little bit about this off of this podcast, was training athletes of various, athletes who like to spend more or less time on the ground, as well as you were talking about pushers and pullers, elastic and inelastic. Mm-hmm. How do you go about training those athletes in regards to their own personal strengths and weaknesses, and what directions do you tend to take them in training?
I think it's just important to give your guys generally what they need. And generally what I need is all components. So again, I want to train all components. I want to make sure they are both strong and elastic, and rhythmical, and have good postures, and all the key things that we want for athletes, all the components apply. What I want to say is, I've gone away from focus on pushers and pullers. So I think it is important to see that way, but I think when you look at it in running, you start to see a different thing. And I think if you look at JB's research, I think you just start to see people that are better at force versus better at velocity. Because I think that was even though it's more vague, to me, it's a clearer, description. Because I'm seeing too much variety of pushes that are good at frequency and at length, and vice versa. I think looking at your stride profile, if your strides are growing every stride, that starts to give you an ability to see this person's qualities are more towards force versus if they get to those longer speeds, 20, 30, 40 meters, and they can't keep increasing that speed, you have to ask yourself, what elastic qualities do they need? I've stopped looking at pushers and pullers, because you see guys in the gym, you might have a pusher, you might have someone who's very strong in their quads and very concentric, and over a 2 to 3 year period, you train them elastically and they change their profile, and then you're confused, and you have a lot of athletes of different athlete history. I think the original term or thoughts behind pushers and pullers was you would also see it in the gym. I just think it's a different entity, and so that's why I don't want to confuse it with that. I think there's too much variety, that some pushes are more ground-based and some, you know, most are more ground-based, but at the highest level, they start to show you that they can be more air-based, they can be more reactive, they just do it a different way. So I'm seeing too much confusion and pushing and pullers in the past couple of years, and I think I'm seeing it because I've got them in my group, and they're changing profiles over time due to training intervention. So it's almost confused me in my young age, and I've almost used the summer to redirect my thought processes on that.
Yeah, that's awesome stuff, and I'm glad you brought that up as well. I've been a little confused by trying to put athletes in their various boxes as well over time, and you're the way you've simplified that, I think that is very helpful. And I, as well as with some of JB's stuff that he's putting out, it's awesome. Could you tell me a little bit about how you implement dribbles into interval and tempo training? How did you arrive at that direction? And then what's the rationale and maybe a typical prescription for someone who is trying to implement dribbles into their training in the form of interval work or tempo work?
I think the reason why we dribble when we tempo is because the winter and the time where you do the most tempo is the time that you want to do your most learning. You know, Dan Pathway says you want to do winter training, you want a base of what? And my mentality is a base of good habits, and being conditioned to perform those habits. And that's why we dribble when we tempo. The volumes, I think the energy system requirement requires you find the general volumes most people do for their tempo in the fall. Maybe, you know, 2,000 meters, you get yourself up to a variety of ways, and then you play with that and drop the volume as the speed comes in. So, you know, we play with that kind of a bandwidth of maybe 1,400 to 3,005 for the four guys. But essentially, I can't say an event would do a certain amount because we have some guys that are dinged or coming back from things, and we would much rather build their energy systems with short reps, even if they perform at a long rep distance, if that makes sense. So tempo volumes are those are the traditional volumes, but when you're dribbling, if you're asking someone to dribble and use their, you know, whatever muscle differently, you know, they're being more reactive in their calf, they're having to use their hip flexors and adductors and abs and a bit more than usual. So you may find that these are the areas that start to fatigue early. So you may not be able to hit the same volumes as you would if you just ran the distance. So maybe you alter between the two types of sessions. An easy tempo session is a dribble session, a really strict posture session, and a harder tempo session is based on energy system development. And of course you bleed those in, but yeah, that would be my answer.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, and all for all the cold weather coaches out there, that's such a great idea, powerful way to do things when you have limited space, just like a hallway.
Yeah, exactly.
What are some of the things, and I've heard you mention this on another podcast, but you've mentioned being creative in year-to-year variations in speed training for advanced athletes. What are some examples of how you might do that or vary things from year to year?
In a year, you have a set of drills. Like we have a warm up A, B, C, a dribble warm up, and a walking warm up. Those are five things that an athlete will do every time they come into the track 5 times a week. So they could do one of them, and they're all kind of variations of another. Mostly. So every year, I try to freshen up the drills. I try to add a bit more, add a bit difference, add a bit of different rhythm, challenge them a bit more. You know, because drills are drills are drills. So you want to keep making sure you're hitting those attractors I mentioned, whilst challenging them to make it harder. And you know, you can add a stick, you can add med ball, or you can add more variety between the actual strokes they're actually doing. You can add some hurdles or cones, or you can add a resistance. You know, I would do most of those things if I feel the other bits have been a bit too monotonous. But eventually, come the season, we'll always come back to warm up A, B, or C, dribble warm up, and walking warm up. So that's what I will do in my warm ups. And in the warm ups are drills and activation and elements of speed, or you know, just key bits you would do before you run. That to me is the most important thing to make sure I vary each year, because after that, it's generally the same thing. We're accelerating, we're doing speed, or we're doing some kind of intensive tempo, or speed endurance. We're doing the fruit of the event so regularly that those other bits are important. And then it's the quality of information the athletes get. You know, for that amount of repetition, you want to be able to measure your improvement. So it's bringing in timing gates or speed guns or up to jump or just giving them access to all of those kind of things, be it at Lee Valley or during training camps. And all of my athletes are near enough nerds when it comes to running splits and velocities and their running model. And other elite athletes running models. And so I have to feed that to keep them going. So that's probably my year-to-year progression. I think sometimes, you know, this is a 4-year cycle. Sometimes I move in terms of theme. You know, last year was a speed year. We were getting ready to race. The year before, I could say it was a more endurance year. Even though we did more endurance volume this year. It's just the theme and the way things progressed, and you know, again, that complex hierarchy. How much time, in proportion over a year, do I spend on, you know, 100%, 90% versus 80%? You know, the week structure sometimes changes. I started using more potentiation type days or sessions. I started doing more double days, where they would do some kind of activation, in the morning, and do their sprint session in the evening. We do that a lot in preparation for major games, especially because they're in the evening. So that's kind of the cycle we would do. But that's only been able to happen because I've been coaching my guys for 3 to 6 years, and they've gone through the year cycles, and they've built that capacity to train my way. When we get a new athlete, I have to bleed them in, and I have to know what they've come from, so that I can figure out what to keep giving them. Whilst I'm bleeding them into how we do things.
Yeah, those are great examples. And I also liked what you mentioned on the some of the years being a little, maybe a little bit more endurance versus speed. I think that's interesting. I mean, I've heard like with 400 runners, for example, if you just train speed your whole career, you're gonna fall short. Or if you just train endurance, you're and vice versa. So is that kind of where you draw that from a little bit in that, or just from other
Yeah,
reasons as
I
well?
think because you, yeah, I think even over a season, over a year, you see progressing more in one variable than the other, and you don't need so much of the other because you want to do the other one, and you kind of move back and forth. You're always doing everything. You notice that there is like a, it's almost like it's compound interest. The more fitter you get, the stronger you are. The stronger you are, the faster you are. The faster you are, the higher the higher speed reserve you have, so you're automatically fitter on the same fitness reserve, and then you just keep building it again and again and again. And I think that happens on a 6-week basis as well as a 6-year basis. Whatever happens on a macro happens on a micro. Yeah, so I think year to year planning, you know, you'll have guys that are ready in Olympic year, and then the year after they're also ready, but after that they drop off for 3 years, even if they're trying to try hard. Or maybe it's planned. It's all about the human body, the resources available, how you can learn from that human body. So I talk about planning all the time, but the reality is my plan is more time dictated by the athlete than it is by what I want. When I push for what I want, they get hurt. That's what I've learned over the past 6 years. If I let them have what they need and figure out how much I can push them towards what I want, that's when they perform. But not when I make them do what I want.
Yeah,
It's a
no.
simple way of looking at things, but for me, it is actually probably my major lesson over the past 6 years.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, athlete-centered training. I've certainly been down that route too. I've been very plyo crazy in the past in my own work. So you mentioned a little bit about how with the warm-ups and kind of funneling the warm-ups down to your basic ones once you get in competitive season. And I've heard like Dan Paff talk about the importance of stabilizing skills for competition. And what are some of your ideas on the nuts and bolts of stabilizing skills and speed in a competitive phase to perform at your highest level?
I think it's our jobs as coaches to make sure we do that. And I think we do that by getting out the way a bit more. And maybe your general prep is about being in the way, and getting involved and making changes and coaching, over coaching your athlete to make sure they understand a certain concept, and then making stress testing it to make sure they remember that concept and they can do it under fatigue or duress. And then the competition, the pre-competition phase is really about allowing them to test it. And it's a real stress test. And then your job as a coach is just fine tuning what are, out of that stress test, you know, what remained good and what didn't remain good. And what's, you know, cost benefit ratio of trying to fix what I didn't think was good. Because if I didn't try and fix it and just trusted the fact that I had got them physically prepared and some of it will be retained, then you leave it alone. And how they perform, you support them and you make some very small cues and small psychological focuses so that they don't have any kind of paralysis for analysis, so that they're focused on what they're planning to do and they feel confident. If you, as a coach, if you always tell them what's wrong going into a major games, you know, every time you train, you know, if you ask them what their goal is, if they reel off 9 things at you, you're in trouble. If they say 1 or 2 or 3, then by all means, you're in a good place. And it's just that confidence to know that they can do what they prepared to do and that they've done it multiple times before. I'm not really a peaking, tapering guy. I think, you know, with the Olympics, oh, sorry, with the Diamond League, you kind of have to be ready from May. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to be ready from May, because in June and July, you'll stress test it, and in August, you'll go to your majors. And there are some tinkerings you can do, and there is some, clearly there is some dropping of chronic load over that period, but in my experience, holding some of that load is also important. It's just managing the density of your speed work, and managing so to me, getting people ready is all about making sure physically and mentally they're prepared, and you as a coach get out of the way. And if you, but also be supportive.
Yeah.
And if you do those things, then generally it goes well. And if you don't, then you just have to pray.
Yeah, absolutely. It, what you were saying, it almost reminds you a little bit about this. And when I'm spending time at the NCAA track and field meets and seeing coaches, athletes do an event and then their coach says like 5 things to them, it probably is indicative of how the last month of practice has been going too. But what you're saying is obviously, you know, just get out of the way more. And then when you're getting ready to peak, the density would go down then as well of the intense stuff.
My most shocking experience is, or not even shocking, but my most, it was shocking experience was being at the Worlds last year with Greg and Dan, because, you know, you're in the coach's room with, or the coach's part of the stand with all the other coaches of all the other athletes, and the amount of feedback going back and forth, really just going forth from the coaches, is amazing. Like so much. And I'm thinking, wow, that's hard. That's hard as an athlete. Whereas I watch Dan, and Greg comes to Dan. Sometimes Dan doesn't say a word. Sometimes he's animated. It all depends on what's actually happened and the stage of the competition. And that to me is the most important thing. You know, Dan, I know that Dan is, you know, older now, so maybe not as jumpy and as enthusiastic as he was 30 years ago. But I think still his personality is one that I feel like if I was around 30 years ago or 20 years ago, he would still have this kind of poise where he doesn't overtalk. You know, some people just think, you know, it's now because Dan, he's got a big moustache, he doesn't talk much. But but I think it's, you know, and he talks a lot in a coaching setting, don't get me wrong. But I mean, on the track, you see he's quite reserved at most times. But when he needs to, he speaks and he's out there. And when he wants to tell stories, he tells really poignant stories. When he wants to give you a one-liner and walk away, those are the most powerful ones. I've watched over the past, you know, since he was in London, he would do those one-liners to my athletes and walk away. And I was amazed by their reaction to it. And my athletes to this day will quote, yeah, well, Dan said this, you know. And it's that the power of silence and the power of talking when you should, not just because you want to, is the most effective thing for coaches.
Yeah, I love it. And that's It's just such great information for coaches. Yeah, we I think we, as a whole, we tend to talk a little bit too much and think about what we're going to say a little too little. So the last three questions I'd like to ask you are in regards to the weight room. And what is your general philosophy on work in the weight room for sprinters and speed-seeking athletes?
Work in a weight room has to complement the track. So having your athlete lift with an S&C coach that doesn't know track, one, who doesn't know your program, two, is very difficult and I think can create more problems than it can help. I see the best track programs being run or being guided by the track coach and then implemented by a very experienced S&C coach who, through the guidance and almost apprenticeship, learns the meaning of track and the real measurement that we'll measure the athletes by. And that, I think, essentially, if your gym program is there to prepare the athlete to deal with your GPP, you know, start to be more explosive during your SPP and can keep strength strong during your competition phase, if your gym program does that for you, then you've ticked all the boxes. That for me is my philosophy on the gym. Before we, you know, really focus on what gym exercise we should do, it's more about what should gym in the whole do for your program.
Okay, and maybe you hinted at this next question in that last answer, but what are your thoughts on the use of more of a general versus specific approach? So using the traditional squat, deadlift, even clean idea versus more specific things where you might be on a single leg or maybe partial squats, things that recreate angles for the sport. What are your thoughts on the balance of those two ideals?
So you said specific was the compound movements and Olympic movements, and what was the general?
Powerlifting, like just general squats, deadlifts.
Okay. I think all things can make an athlete stronger, right? And doing any kind of stimulus can make an athlete stronger, be it in a gym or carrying stuff and climbing and, you know, pulling stuff. I think all things can make someone stronger. I think in a gym, what you have is an opportunity to look at what Kelvin Giles talks about, push, pull, brace, rotate, right? Mm-hmm. Or even brace, rotate, and hinge. Yeah. The hinge is the big thing that we always wonder about is, okay, well, should the guys be doing a deadlift or should they be doing a squat? That's where a lot of the push-pull stuff started coming from, because some people were more quad dominant, some people more hamstring dominant. I think in the gym, you can train my attractors really well. I think you can break down the attractors and say, well, projection is all about strength to weight ratio. So it's really all about those compound lifts. It's about the Olympic lifts and any derivative that is appropriate for you as a coach. It's about squatting and deadlifting and doing them double leg and doing them single leg, doing them slow for rate of, for time under tension, and doing them fast for more rate of force development. I think a coach can go along that spectrum as far as they want, depending on what they're doing outside on the track. You may not need to do much rate of force development in the gym. All you do is decrease some of your load so that you can, in that phase, do far more depth jumps, drop jumps, and any other derivative of plyometric you choose to do. I think in the end, you end up ticking the same box. It's just maybe what's more appropriate for that athlete. Is it more appropriate to develop those qualities by doing jump squats and drop jumps loaded in the gym? Or is it better to do it out on the track where you're doing more dynamic athletic plyometric activity? So that's where, for me, specificity kind of lies. When I need to be specific, what do I use? Do I use more heavy plyometrics, shock method type stuff out on the track, or am I going to do it in a gym? And, you know, for safety, if I got a delicate athlete, I'm going to do it in a gym. It makes more sense. More general work, well, I like both philosophies, so I'm kind of greedy. I like train movements, not muscles. I love that. But I like to train muscles too. If I know a muscle is weak or a segment is weak, some people just think I'm putting more dysfunction on dysfunction. But I think it, you know, School of Hard Knocks shows that when we really focus on the muscle, and if the muscle's weak, we get it bigger, and we know that it's going to affect it's going to affect the pronation angle for that tendon, and normally tendon issues are the what you know we're dealing with these guys. I'm going to blow it up. I'm going to do some occlusion training. I'm going to do some, you know, bodybuilding type reps and sets for that segment or body part or whatever it is to give it some cross-sectional area. I know it ticks an important robustness box for me, but it's not the only tick. It just helps with the timelining and accelerated rehab. So the general for me, if I know it fixes me during rehab, it's something I'm going to do throughout the year anyway. So I'll go back to my first statement. I kind of train all things at all times. And I just try to make sure it complements the end goal and any of the sub goals.
Yeah, awesome. That reminds me a little bit, I think, of something I heard Vern Gambetta say, like throwing the spectrum of means at the athlete and seeing which things they respond to and being able to use all those appropriately. I guess that would
Exactly.
sum it up. Yeah. So this last question, it makes me, after that great answer, is it makes me look a little bit like a simpleton because I'm trying to reduce the weight room down to a couple things or one thing. But I guess the last question I would have was if, and I originally had some key exercises, but what would you say? Is there any one or maybe two exercises that you tend to like to see like fast athletes be fairly good at? Obviously, there's exceptions,
Well,
but.
I'll jump on the Nordic hype. I love Nordics and raises and anything in a glute ham machine. I like what has become called a Bosch hold, which is like a glute ham raise hold, a back extension hold almost.
Okay.
And I like to do them isometrically, like at any time in a year, and build up capacity to do it relatively heavy isometrically at any time in a year. And at appropriate times in the year, I'm going to do more concentric type move. I'll have movement involved and do it single leg, heavy, unloaded, loaded. I'll kind of get some variety, get some eccentric stress going through. Obviously, Nordics just give you eccentric straight away. You know, not everyone can do them. If you have guys that you know, distal head of the biceps are really stressed and they don't like doing Nordics because of that. Or Nordics gives them knee pain. I've had a few girls over the past year where the Nordics gave them knee pain because the distal biceps are just and hamstrings are just tugging on the tibia backwards and it's just shearing. So there are some exercises I think are important, which is essentially big bums, big hammies, and strong bums, strong hammies. But in chasing that goal, it can create other issues. So then you have to regress, regress, regress.
Gotcha. And I really like the long isos. So you're really trying to build that position up early in the year before you
Yeah,
you
straight
like those.
away. Yeah, I believe if I need it, I'll do it now. Now, last year with the development guys, we didn't do any Nordics for at least 12 weeks, maybe longer, maybe 16 weeks, because most of them were new and they were coming into a speed program. And you know, no Nordic, why do we want Nordic or you know the glute ham raise type stuff? It's because it's eccentric hamstring stuff. And if you're doing that in your speed, and it's new to someone, layering on that other stuff, it doesn't make sense. And it's a big program anyway. We're doing RDLs, we're doing a range of other more compound based movements. But I know if I could only send someone in the gym for 10 minutes, and I knew they had hamstring history, or my needs analysis says I need a hamstring a lot, like I do in sprinting, I'm gonna go and train a hamstring.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a great point on how to progress, and I think that's something a lot of coaches can benefit. Yeah, because we all love our Nordic hamstrings, or at least we've all heard of them. So just that idea on integrating them, I think, is great.
I mean, people could argue, why wouldn't you do a overhead squat or a clean or all those other movements? I think the reason is because I know I can jump, and I know my philosophy kind of demands that most times I see someone, I'm going to watch them jump and do a movement, even if it's at the lowest level, and do some kind of triple joint extension either in one movement or in multiple movements. So that's my job as a coach. I know I'm going to coach that, and I could out on the track get them to do hamstring holds against the wall, you know, and we do. because we know that's the biggest thing we want to fix and or we want to address. And you can point the foot in or point the foot out, and you can actually bias medial or lateral structures. So, you know, in loading, I don't wait to get in the gym. If I know something needs to get done and it's a weak link, you know, I think you might as well focus on it right now and get it done.
Awesome. Yeah, I hadn't really heard about anyone doing Nordics with the medial lateral bias, but it makes sense. I've heard a lot of like therapists and things talk about how one side can be weaker than the other, and why shouldn't
or you
coaches...
can use EMG, or you can use a complex or something like that if you want to bias a muscle. That's another way you could do it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. Cool. Well, hey Jonas, that's all the questions I had for you for this podcast. But thank you so much for being on. Loved your answers, and I learned a lot. I'm sure that all the coaches listening did as well. So I really thank you for your time here today.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again for tuning in today. Again, please visit our sponsor, Simply Faster, if you are interested in anything that has to do with high-end training tools for speed development in athletes, K-Box, the 1080 Sprint, GymAware, SpeedMat, you name it, they got it. Check them out. Also, please subscribe on your listening platform of choice. It would really help me out. I really appreciate it. So iTunes, Stitcher, add us to your favorite, subscribe. I would love it if you go ahead and did that. And we will see you guys next week. We have Mark Watts, former education director of Elite FTS. And I cannot wait to get that out for you guys. It's going to be a great one. Until then, we'll see you and have a great week.